Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hello and welcome to Caged In Pigcast, a deep dive look into Michael Zarnowski's 2021 drama Pig. This week I had the absolute pleasure of sitting down with both Philip Klein and Alexis Grapsas to talk about the score for this film and their kind of unique way of how they came together to do the score. And I'm sure if you've seen the film, you'll definitely agree that it's some beautiful music. You can hear a piece under me right now. I think this conversation is relatively spoiler-free, so if you haven't seen the film, you can still listen to this one. I would obviously recommend that you do watch the film, which you can watch in UK cinemas right now, as well as checking out altitude.film to find out where it is streaming, as well as where is your local cinema listing. I'll also be putting links in the show notes so you can easily find all of that information. So please enjoy my conversation with Alexis Grapsas and Philip Klein, and please ignore the moment where my brain falls out of my head. Today on the podcast, I have the absolute pleasure of not being joined by one, but two of the composers of the soundtrack for Pig, both Alexis Grapsas and Philip Klein. How are you guys?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having us.
Yeah, likewise. Thanks a lot for the invitation and having us on the show.
No worries. Well, I guess the best place to start off with is how you guys got involved with the project. Was it Phil who came on first, or was it you, Alexis?
It was actually me that came on first. I was involved quite early in the process, and I read the script while they were shooting, and I had to write some first ideas and demos, as we call it, in our world, to even be considered and actually eventually get the gig. It was something that was a work in progress from everybody, and started discussing with the filmmakers early on, and then we were on this for a while. This project was like a long process, and at some point, due to some personal scheduling conflicts I had and other things that were happening for me, I had to ask for some creative help. And Phil was the first person that came to mind, because we've known each other for many years, and have collaborated in the past in various ways, even though we've never actually shared the credit on a film. This is our first time together, co-scoring something. And it was, you know, the only person I could think of and wanted to bring on board. And then he basically, you know, took over a lot of the stuff that I've done and, you know, took it home and did an incredible job continuing the ground that I had set and the sounds that me and filmmakers have been, you know, working on for a while.
So what was the state of the score when it was kind of handed to you, Phil? Was it kind of like, how much of it was the bones of it, most of it there?
Oh yeah. I mean, I'm very grateful that I got a co-scoring credit. Alexis has done, as I said, a lot of the heavy lifting at that point. I mean, he had kind of gone through the process with the filmmakers of, you know, trying out a lot of sounds, trying a lot of textures, melodic content and stuff like that. So by the time I got involved, yes, I mean, by all means, the foundation was pretty firm at that point. I mean, I was basically filling in the gaps of cues that hadn't been written yet. Mm-hmm. And, you know, if there were some notes on something that, you know, they had a couple bars they didn't like in one of Alexis's cues, or they wanted a slightly different version in another thing, I would just kind of like open his sessions and start working on that. So, I mean, it's hard to put a quantity, on percent wise, but I think if we think of Alexis as the starter and me as the closer in baseball, it would be similar to that.
So I'd be interested to know, what were some of the like touchstones that Michael Zarnowski would have had for you in regards to, was there any temp score ever, or was there more discussions of like, this is the kind of thing that we're looking for, whether it's in popular music or, I don't know, with like the needle drops in there, was that, what was the Bruce Springsteen song always in the script?
There was quite a bit of temp score and even a variety of different temp scores, ideas that were tried through the process. Even stuff that, you know, Brett, the picture editor, had tried before, mm-hmm. with Michael, or even later on, we brought an amazing music editor on board. His name is Clint Bennett, whose actual, you know, most recent credit is Dune, the new Hans Zimmer scored film that's coming out right now. And he helped us a lot to set some foundation with the temp. I don't want to go into any details because I don't think, you know, talking about temp music is necessarily a very interesting topic. But the main thing that Michael was always picking, you know, small pieces from here and there from the temp. He was never really happy with anything, which was actually great for us because we had the opportunity to create something, you know, unique. But it would be mostly a conversation about, you know, this is what I'd like about this part, but this is what's not working for me. This is what I'm not getting out of this. This is completely wrong. And it's a good way to communicate with a director who doesn't, you know, necessarily speak in a musical language. But we also had, like Phil said, you know, we had a lot of trial and error. A lot of times, you know, the film shifted a lot from its original point, even from the first, you know, cut that we saw with the first edit, where it started and where it is in its final form. It's, you know, a different film. So the music was shifting and the approach was shifting along with that. We wrote, you know, tons of music, like lots of hours of music that nobody will ever hear that did not, you know, make it in the film. So it was a lot of that, but we never really had a solid temp for this music. And we also, you know, had great input from the filmmakers as well, because there was, you know, sometime in the process that everybody was feeling lost, and then somebody would throw an idea and was like, what about this, or, you know, what about that, and it would unlock new things and possibilities, and that would be our new jumping point in terms of inspiration or where to draw something from.
I don't think that I'm on Fire was always in the script either. I'm aware there were discussions about several different songs, and then they ended up going with that one.
That's true. There was another song actually that was in the script that everybody wanted, but you know how it is with licensing and budgets and indie films, like you don't always get what you want.
That it's really interesting because obviously looking at the kind of needle drops that we have in here, there's one that almost sounds like it could have been a part of the score. And it wasn't until I kind of like was digging deeper today. I think it's a track called A Dead Man Walking. Oh, no, it's not. No, it wasn't that one. It was Black Veil by Rose Blood. That very much feels like it's in keeping with your score. Like, what were the discussions on, like, kind of instrumentation, likewise? Was it always kind of guitar led, or were there other kind of instruments that were thrown about before you landed on that kind of quite guitar heavy score?
Yeah, Alexis, how many instruments did you use until you got to a guitar?
Like I said, we've tried everything you can possibly imagine. I mean, we started from a piano score, orchestral score, electronic score, purely folk acoustic to more electric grunge guitar. The best way to describe it, initially, we were trying for a tone, right? For an overall tone, which kind of landed for us. When a couple of instruments came to place and started, combining a sound, like one of the trademark sounds of this score that you hear, in the beginning and in the end of the film, when Rob, Nick Cage character, is in the forest and he lives this serene life, is, a bowed cavaquinho. Cavaquinho is a very small plucked Brazilian instrument, basically, that we tried to play in a non-conventional way. And I was working with this amazing guitarist, and he's started experimenting stuff in the studio, and he when he played that, I said, okay, let's try that. This is a sound that could do something, and it provides a very brittle and kind of like almost ethereal sound into the whole thing that creates something almost, magical, as if somebody has found their peace and their absolute place of happiness. And at the same time, this was combined with something, with a very raw sound, which is a baritone violin. So instead of having like a classical proper sounding, instrument of the orchestra, we had this custom instrument that one of our musicians had. His name is Paul Cartwright. He's an incredible violin player. And we tried this instrument played in a very raw, almost folksy way. And that created a very nice juxtaposition of darkness with the other sound we had created. And then there was always this idea that we want to create something a little more raw and grungy and electric when we move from the forest into the city. And that was something that Michael always, the director, used to say as a direction, and he was asking for. So that's kind of how the electric guitars and the sound came on. It's basically, how can we take this and create that atmosphere with a more, grungy, distorted sound as we follow the journey into the city?
I think it's interesting too. I mean, Alexis has spoken about this in the past. It's just, at one point there was like, band kind of like big band thrown out as an idea, and so like there are little hints of horns that play underneath that theme in the opening and the ending. And again, it's not even something you would actually probably clock on a conscious level, but it's there, and it gives this kind of like indie vibe in the background of it all. And I mean, that's kind of the art of assimilating what a director wants into something that's appropriate for the film.
I take it one of the things, because obviously you mentioned there's lots of music that was used for this, was silence ever talked about a lot in regards to like your job on it? Were there certain scenes where Michael was insistent that there is no music for this? Because it's a very bold film in that it kind of, there are drawn out sections where there is no music whatsoever.
There was a full cue written for the opening of that movie that they only basically used the last third of in the film, and there were plenty of instances, I think, where we were kind of constantly asking ourselves, is this better scored or unscored? Is it better just to be played with sound design or whatever? And I think Michael is really interested in that kind of exploration of kind of rawness versus the sheen that a score inherently adds to a film. So, I would say that was a huge discussion in several points. And I'm sure with Alexis, when he was on, it was a huge thing. And certainly as I came on, it became, as we were finishing the score, it became even maybe a little more kind of, you know, the forefront of like, should we be doing this or shouldn't we be doing this? Or, you know, so yeah, it was definitely a big part of the process.
And one other thing is that, you know, sometimes you don't know until you actually see it. I mean, even me and Phil, who are, you know, professional composers, sometimes don't know the right answer. Yeah. We don't expect sometimes, you know, someone who's not a musician to know the answer of what the music should be and what it should do. And, you know, sometimes the best solution is let's write something, let's put it against picture, see if it works. If it doesn't work, we are going to be the first ones who's going to say, you know, this has to come out. This is not working. And we both have the same philosophy in terms of, you know, approach on how we approach a film. Like, you know, we don't like to overload films with music. We always want to put music when it's needed and when it's adding something that's not necessarily already there. And that's why it was easy for us to also work on this film together, because, you know, we were the first ones who wanted music out when it wasn't necessary. It was a process, obviously, to get there and reach the choices that you see as the final product in the film. But I think we both agree on the fact that silence works great in a lot of places in this movie. And there's a lot of sad or dark moments that, you know, everything you need is there. Like, the performances are great, the editing is great, and you don't need anything else there. Music should not just make it, you know, more sad or more melodramatic or something like that, you know. So it all depends also on what you're working with. Sometimes it's not just our decision. The movie and the scene has to give you a lot of this information. That's why it's a collaborative process with the director and the editor as well.
That's really fascinating. I kind of like, because looking at the score itself, like on like any streaming service, it's 28 minutes long. And it's that felt like hearing you guys talk about the fact that you wrote hours of it, it's like, of music, is vastly interesting to me. But at the same time, I think it is like the score itself, like, works beautifully within this film and manages to capture, I think, with Pat Scola's amazing cinematography, this kind of magical realism that the film is kind of evokes, in the fact that it feels like it's somewhat, I don't know, a couple of degrees to the left of the reality we live in. Like, was that kind of stuff, I don't know, what were the discussions in regards to stuff like that? Was it, I don't quite, it's hard to talk about music, right? It's that thing of like, it's an unquantifiable feeling and kind of texture you get from score.
I think one thing we both kind of agreed on early on is that Nick's performance is so strong in this film that it just doesn't need music in a lot of places. You know what I mean? So I think so much of that kind of like hyper-realism or kind of less hyper-realism is just about letting his performance do its thing. And you know, when we want to feel something a little more kind of to the left, as you're saying, of that, we then can kind of, because there's not that much music in the score, when you do use it, it becomes that much more powerful in a way.
It does sound very, very simple, but one of the fundamental, you know, things I always have in mind when you work with a film like that, it's just to, you know, try to not get in the way and not mess it up.
Yeah.
And Phil, in the beginning, when we were talking about our collaboration, you know, he really likes to downplay his role because he came in at the end. But it's really easy to tell somebody, why don't you take this idea and make something with it and, you know, mess it up. So, you know, that's a very rare thing that I very hardly find in collaborations with people, to know exactly what to do at the right time. And minimalism is something that, you know, sounds very easy in a lot of cases when you hear the final thing, but it's a very difficult process to get there and throw all the other stuff out and all the hours of music we wrote and all the, you know, noise and ideas we had to reach to a point where you're like, you know, this is what I'm going to go with. I'm going to use these three instruments. And this is the moment in the film where I want this to happen. So, there were a lot of discussions about that, but it was mostly an unconscious, instinctive effort towards that. It wasn't a plan.
Okay, so one of the things I really want to talk about is the way that you kind of approach a score. Where do you tend to start when it comes to scoring something? Is it kind of, I know that there's, I think that Brazilian instrument you talked about creates this like great motif that we get at the beginning and end of this. Is it something like that come early, or is it kind of just you start at the beginning of the film, or do you just pick a scene and go, I'm going to start here?
I've never done the same thing twice in between two films. So I'm just going to try to narrow it down to, you know, this film. And the way I usually work, and I think it's pretty much the same way that Phil works, is when in the beginning you just try to write some themes and basically come up with a concept and a sound that you don't necessarily worry too much about what scene is going to go or how is that going to work with that dialogue line or whatever. You're just trying to create a feeling and something that when somebody hears it, do you hear your movie in there? Will the director see that being part of that movie? Will we get the overall emotion that we're looking for from that film? The theme that, you know, is the pig theme was, you know, written on a piano. I mean, you never hear it on a piano, but then I ended up trying it on different instruments. And that instrument was like, I don't know, the 8th or 9th idea I tried that landed. It wasn't the first thing that came to mind. And maybe we wrote, I don't know, 10 different themes with 10 different sounds for that movie. And essentially we landed on the proper one. So sometimes I was very lucky to just write something and the director tell me, I love it, this is it. Sometimes I've had to go the way of really exploring deep and say, yeah, I've got to write this again and again and again and really, you know, dig until I get it right. But Phil can elaborate more on his approach, but this is usually mine. I just write something sometimes even without picture and then put it on a scene or a key moment of the film and see if the overall vibe is right for me and if it's working with what I'm going for.
Yeah, I mean, I'm very similar. And it was obviously a little different experience for me on this one because I didn't start at the beginning of the process. But my approach at the beginning is pretty much exactly that. I watch the film several times with and without the temp. And then I basically just sit at a piano or I go for walks or whatever. But I always find the first 2 to 3 weeks of working on a film to be the messiest part for me. I mean, I really like question my whole talent and all this kind of stuff. I go through so much kind of like denial and doubt about what's going to happen. And then suddenly something will happen, you know, and some theme will pop into my head or some harmonic change will come into my head. And like Alexa says, I mean, you know, you can write something on the piano and think like, I can hear how this can work. But until you find the right sound for that theme or that the orchestration of it or the setting of, you know, those chords or whatever, it can still kind of be messy. You know, you think you have it, but then you're not finding the right vibe or the musical environment for it. And I think that kind of is the second part of the process for me, is like, what are the colors of the score? And that to me is like where it really takes a long time in a way. I mean, harmonically and thematically, it tends to come faster to me than it does like, okay, so now how are we going to make this sound good? You know,
yeah.
I mean, unless it's like a straight orchestral score, which I do get asked to write quite a bit, but this was certainly not that, you know, it was always going to be something unique. So I think like, that's why I always downplay, I guess, my role, is because Alexis did all that work of like finding the colors that, yeah. that were going to be the score. And then, you know, I really didn't have to deal with that part of the process as much. I mean, certainly.
And it's funny, the thing that Phil mentioned, that, you know, first 2-3 weeks, it's a terrifying time for pretty much every composer. And it's, you know, it's also what kind of like makes it fun, but it's where you actually, you know, have no idea what you're going to do. And you think you might write the most brilliant thing in the world. And then the editor will send you a new cut. You'll put it on, you know, against picture. And for some reason, it doesn't work. You can't explain why, because mm-hmm. you hear it on its own and you think it's brilliant because you wrote it, and you put it against picture and something throws it out. And that's the beauty of it, that there's no formula. I mean, sometimes I cannot even explain why. Mm-hmm. I can just know whether it works or doesn't work. And the other very interesting thing here is about what you do in the beginning, is that one thing that's also terrifying for me sometimes mm-hmm. is that, you know, you start interacting with filmmakers, directors, and producers that have been with this project for maybe a couple of years. And they know this story and this character and what they have in the mind, like, very, very well. And you jump in on something after messing with it for 2 weeks. And, you know, you're competing against time, basically, that they've spent with this project. And, you bring something fresh and something new, but there's no way you know the story and the characters and the vision better than them. And that's always a very, you know, terrifying thing for me that I'm trying to be aware of on what I bring to the table at that moment in time.
This next question is probably going to be like somewhere to the left of thingy, but I think you guys might be able to, I don't know, at least give your opinions on it. Obviously, like, the character of Amir in this is constantly listening to classical music. As people who obviously deal in, I don't know, emotive music, to kind of, yeah, in tapping into what music can like tell us about a character or something like that, what do you think that the kind of Amir's obsession with listening to classical music tells us about that character?
I mean, I think it's just his constant need to try to be in higher society. He's trying to live up to that kind of wealth level that his father has. And to him, that's being cultured in the sense of not necessarily loving classical music, but just knowing something about it, you know? And I mean, that's probably why he drives a car that he can't really drive and you know, dresses very nicely and all that kind of stuff. But, you know, it's all part of his ruse, I guess, as just trying to be something that he's not, I guess.
Yeah, and it's also funny. I mean, it just makes his character even more bizarre because you see this 20-year-old kid driving a, you know, yellow Carrera, and then he's just listening to Beethoven. So it just doesn't make sense. But it kind of like circles back at the end of the movie, like Phil said, when we go back into his dad's house, and his dad is also a big classical music lover. That's all the music that plays when we are in his place. And it's the acceptance he's looking for from that environment. So other than the funny element, the comedic element, it kind of has a story depth behind those two characters and how they come.
That's what I think, like, this very much for me feels like a film that kind of, I don't know, everyone's pushing in the right direction and kind of, what, like, did it feel like that working on the project? Was it kind of like everyone is like going for the same goal? In the regards to like how the film, like watching it, and kind of, I've had the pleasure of speaking to Vanessa Block and David Now and Brett Buckman, stuff like that, and sounds like everybody kind of had an idea of what the film was like. Everyone was pushing in the right direction. Did it feel like that? Or I don't know how to ask this without sounding like a loaded question. Like, I don't know, it feels like there's some kind of magic came together to get this to work. Or
Phil, you're gonna go first.
It's a hard question to answer, because as a composer, I think like you come into those situations, and in music is this thing that kind of everyone has an opinion about, you know, it's mm-hmm. a completely subjective thing. And so, you know, oftentimes there are disagreements. I don't want to say there's arguments. I mean, sometimes it gets into arguments, but not so much on this movie. Everybody disagrees sometimes when you're like, I don't think that's the best way to do this, or I want this and I don't think we should be doing that. But I do think that, you know, we all obviously want to create a good movie and hopefully a great movie and an experience that makes people feel something. And I think in that regard, yes, of course, everybody was on the same page. I mean, no one, I think, had this like gigantic ego that we were all fighting against or anything. You know, we were all pretty young filmmakers in a sense that maybe don't have that yet. Hopefully don't ever have it. But I think, you know, I think Michael always had a pretty clear idea of what he wanted the final product to be. And I think that it's important and it goes for any creative position to kind of acknowledge that maybe you don't always have the answer on how it ends up that way. You just know that, you know, you want it to feel a certain way by the end of it. And I think that's like the beauty of film in general, the collaborative process. It's like leaning on your creative partners and collaborators and the people that are directing you or producing, and just saying like, you know, I'm not sure how we're going to get here, but I think we'll figure it out. And in that respect, then yes, Pig to me was very much that. We weren't always sure on how it was going to end up, where it was going to end up, but you know, we got there and it turned out pretty well at the end of it. So I think, I would agree with the statement in general, for sure. That doesn't mean it's not messy sometimes.
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, my experience also was a little more extensive than Phil's, because I was a part of the more early discussions that, you know, there were a lot of heated arguments and strong opinions. But like Phil said, like, it was always for the best of the film. And it was kind of there was a smaller circle of people that, you know, were focusing purely on the creative side of things. And, you know, that circle, other than Michael, obviously, was Vanessa Block, who co-wrote it and was also a main producer on the movie, and Dimitra Tsingu, who's also a main producer on the film. So these were the three, you know, most creative voices that would interact with us on a daily basis before we open it up to, you know, a larger circle of people. And in close collaboration with the picture editor, of course, for the more technical aspect of things. But it wasn't a very, very clear vision from the beginning. And it's, for me, this is something very interesting that happened with this movie, because you say it all kind of like fell into the right mm-hmm. place at some point. Like, we didn't know exactly how we're going to get there. And we didn't have maybe the most productive or effective process ever, but we got there. And there were a lot of different opinions and different shifts during the process, but it worked. And for me, this is the most important thing, that everybody wanted to make the best film we can absolutely make with what we have. And, you know, if there's some heated argument discussions we're going to have along the way, I'm all for it, because it's, you know, we're trying to create something unique, and we're not all going to agree all the time about everything, because we're different artists and we have different views on things.
Yeah, I totally understand. I know that, like Brett Buckman said at one point, there was a 3-hour assembly cut of this movie. So I can understand there was probably some chiseling away before we kind of got this finished project that we see today.
Yeah, it's the same as we have about 10 hours. Work of music that we've written. I mean, you know, there's a lot of footage that, you know, you could have in the movie, but we all decided to that final thing, which you know, has great perception by everybody, and we're all very happy with that result.
So what was both of your reactions like, as I start to wrap things up, like, what were your reactions when you finally got to see the film? Have you both had the opportunity to kind of sit down and just enjoy it, as opposed to like working on it?
Yeah, I mean, we were at the Dub together when they were kind of finishing the mix of the whole film. And I mean, that's a bit of a different experience to actually sitting down in the theater and watching it, because we're still kind of in work mode at that point to help, you know, chisel the levels and make sure everything's sitting nicely in the film. But I had went to the premiere out here in LA, and it was a very interesting experience. There were a lot of parts that I just didn't, I guess I appreciate it on a different level when you're sitting with an audience around, you know, when you're feeling the energy of people laughing or crying or, you know, holding their breath, waiting for something to happen. And at one point my wife like leaned over to me and she said, "This is a very, very good movie." You know, and I think like, I that's when I kind of started to really realize like we had, I mean, certainly the reviews were coming out before the premiere, but you know, and they were all very, very positive. But I think that when I finally saw it at the premiere, and you know, you have that kind of audience level participation of feeling. I definitely took on a new appreciation for what we had done. You know, I think you really kind of maybe lose sight of that when you're deep in the throes of trying to figure out creatively what you're even doing, and so that was a nice surprise, I guess, for me. Not that it was unexpected, but just it was a nice moment.
Yeah, I didn't actually get a chance, unfortunately, to watch this in a theater with an audience. I only watched it in the, you know, our final dub room with the filmmakers when we were playing the film back. Yeah, I think this is, you know, due to the times we live in with COVID restrictions and everything, something that a lot of filmmakers are missing, to enjoy their films in a premiere with proper audiences and the whole nine yards. And it's something that I've always experienced in the past, that when you actually watch a movie in a theater with an audience, that's the instinctively, you know, if something is working or not, even if you've seen the movie 1,000 times, when you watch it with other people around you that are watching it for the first time, there's just a weird thing that's happening, that you realize what you did well, what you did wrong, what you could have done better, and it's a completely different experience. And I really miss that from this film. But I think we all knew from the beginning that, you know, we have something good in our hands. I don't think we knew how good it was, because you lose perspective at some point. So I admit that I was pleasantly surprised that it seems like that we have something better than maybe I was expecting when I was really involved in the film, and I was really in it. You know, I had lost perspective. I couldn't be subjective.
Perfect. Well, it sounds like both of you kind of went on a hunt of your own to kind of find like the perfect score for this film, and I'm so glad it's obviously worked out and the film is getting such high praise from reviews and stuff like that, and the public really seem to be digging it. I always like to end the podcast by asking my guests just one question, and that is, what is your personal favorite Nick Cage movie?
I mean, complete guilty pleasure, but I love The Rock.
Perfect. And yourself, Alexis?
Yeah, that's a tough one. I'm gonna go with Raising Arizona.
Perfect. Both.
As you can see, Alexis is much more into cinema, I guess.
Hey, they both
give me
have
some
their
visual
place.
Effects.
They both definitely have their place. Well, guys, it's been an absolute pleasure of having you on the podcast. Thank you so much for coming and joining me.
Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thanks you for having us, and we'll speak soon. Thanks, Patrick.
Cheers, guys. And there we go, guys. There is another Pigcast in the sty, as it were. If you enjoyed this episode, please do go back and listen to my other interviews that I've done with people from in front of or behind the camera with this film. So you've got Brett W. Buckman, the fantastic editor, who also edited Mandy and Colour Out of Space. You have David Nell, who plays the fantastic chef Derek Finway, who, if you've seen Pig, you know, kind of really puts in a steam ceiling performance in that kind of middle, like, kind of, I don't know, yeah, centerpiece scene we get in this film. And then there's the co-writer and producer Vanessa Block, who we get some fantastic chat in that episode, talking about how this film, how male-centric it is, how it's kind of got the beating heart of femininity underneath it, whether that's kind of heads of production or the crew or kind of in the writing itself. And then we have my interview with Chris Zarnecki, the head chef of the Joel Palmer House in Oregon, who taught Nick to look the part when it came to being a chef. So if you've enjoyed this one, go back. You'll be able to find them pretty easy. All you have to do is type in Caged In Pigcast onto your podcast platform. Or you're listening to this episode, so just scroll back. They're kind of all listed as bonus episodes. As well as make sure you listen to the most current episode of the podcast at the time of release, which was my conversation with Andrew Pope, kind of dissecting the film as a whole. And yeah, hopefully there may be some more pig-filled conversations in the future, so keep an eye and an ear out for all of that. And if you enjoyed the podcast as well, please be sure to rate, review and subscribe on Acast, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you're listening to this podcast right now. One final thing as well, it saddens me to say that Brandy, the pig from Pig, has sadly passed away. So let's have a moment of silence for Brandy and keep her in our thoughts as we kind of ride out on this episode. As always, guys, I've been Betch Spatsilivus. I've been Caged In. I'll catch you next time.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Need new glasses or want a fresh new style? Warby Parker has you covered. Glasses start at just $95, including anti-reflective, scratch-resistant prescription lenses that block 100% of UV rays. Every frame's designed in-house with a huge selection of styles for every face shape. And with Warby Parker's free home try-on program, you can order 5 pairs to try at home for free. Shipping is free both ways, too. Go to warbyparker.com/covered to try 5 pairs of frames at home for free. Warbyparker.com/covered.
Acast powers the world's best podcasts. Here's a show that we recommend.
Want to join a film club that has real, frank discussions, talking about films that you actually want to watch?
Well, then look no further, because we are Frank Film Club with me, Maisie Williams. And each week we watch a film and then come together and obsess over it, or sometimes absolutely slate it. Either way, there's always a lot to say. And the films that we pick range all the way from like 90s and noughties classics all the way up to new releases that are coming out every single week. And sometimes we get our listeners to pick for us.
And we all work in the film industry, don't we, ladies?
Indeed.
So we really love to look at specifically how a film was made.
So if this sounds like your bag, then come and have a listen to Frank Film Club. And remember, absolutely everyone is welcome in this club.
Acast helps creators launch, grow, and monetize their podcasts everywhere. Acast.com.
This podcast is presented by the Breadcrumbs Collective, home of the Podcharles Cinecast, Caged In Coppola Connections, A Drip Town Limerie Maine, Franchised, and many more to come. Our shows are all presented ad-free and made possible by listeners like you. Please support our shows by subscribing, leaving ratings and reviews, and becoming patrons at patreon.com. If you'd like to learn more about Breadcrumbs, head over to breadcrumbscollective.com.
Breadcrumbs. It's more than a podcast network. It's family.